You're listening to Choose FI Radio. The blueprint for financial independence lives here. If you're looking to unlock the secrets to financial independence and early retirement, you're in the right place. Stay tuned and join a community of like-minded people who are getting off the hamster wheel and taking control of their lives in the pursuit of financial independence. Choose FI, your home for financial independence online.
All right, guys, super excited to dive into this week's episode. We are going to be speaking with Lisa Duke, a member of the financial independence community and a financial coach. What's really interesting about this is we met her for the first time at FinCon. And then very recently, we actually got a message from Brian Uffinger telling us how impressed he was both with her story and her journey to financial independence, her approach at coaching and mindset, but also just some stuff that she's actually executing on in their local area of Georgia with regards to VRBOs and vacation rental properties. Just really her story runs the gamut. And I think there's going to be a lot of actionable content here for our audience. And to help me with this, I have my co-host Brad here with me today. How you doing, buddy?
Hey, Jonathan, I'm doing quite well. And yeah, this should be a great episode. Like you said, we met Lisa at FinCon last year, and I actually spent Camp Phi down in Florida with her this January. And she just has an absolutely infectious energy. She's incredibly intelligent, just has a wealth of knowledge, and is the perfect person for the podcast. So of course, we wanted to have her on. And then to get a message from Brian like that saying, hey guys, I don't know if you've heard of Lisa, but you need to have her on. And we responded back, yeah, Brian, we're interviewing her 48 hours from now. So it was just so unbelievably perfect. So with that, Lisa, welcome to the Choose FI podcast.
Oh, thank you. I'm excited to be here. I'm definitely in that category of longtime listener and first time caller.
Oh man, I can't tell you how it warms my heart when someone says that. And Lisa, I really wanted to dive into your personal money story, but I wanted to talk about the shift from you from spender to wealth builder, because spender and wealth builder don't often go together. Normally you do need to have a paradigm shift. And I'm curious, like with your specific story, how did that shift occur?
Well, it's really tied up in my story of how I found you all and the financial independence community. My husband and I owned our own business. We were doing really well. We made good money, but it just seemed like no matter how much money we made, how much we spent, it didn't really bring us much lasting pleasure. We were sort of on that hedonic treadmill of you buy something and it feels great, and then the excitement kind of goes away and the bills associated with that thing remain. And we were really trying to buy our way to happiness. We were in this enormous 4-bedroom, 3.5-bath house on the fancy side of Atlanta. We had a vacation house because a colleague of my husband's said that that would fix my husband. He was in a little bit of a slump. So clearly we needed a vacation home. And then we also had an SUV because once a year we have to take the dog to the vet. I don't know why we thought the dog couldn't fit in a car. He fits in the car just fine now. But, and then the biggest thing we had was a fancy truck. It had not just a heated steering wheel, but the steering wheel was also air conditioned.
So you could have cattle in the back and heads of state in the front, right?
Exactly. Exactly. Business in the front, party in the back. The mullet of vehicles.
Write that down, Brad. Write that down.
Oh, that's amazing. Best quote ever on Choose a Pie.
Yeah. So we had all of this stuff and we weren't unhappy, but we just weren't satisfied. We didn't really feel like we were making any progress in life. We had been working at the business. And then, of course, we had this huge slump in 2008 with the economy. I just kind of got to a point where I thought, I don't know what the point of all of this is. My husband, right around that time, transitioned to, we still have our IT consulting business as our side hustle, but he went to be a direct employee with our biggest client, and he was commuting across Atlanta every day. He does not do well with road rage. So we...
I think Atlanta is in a perpetual state of road rage.
We are. The traffic is insane. Although I'm kind of to the point where I'm embracing it. if the traffic is bad enough, then people have to move in town. And I think that plus we've got a Beltline project that's kind of a walking trail. I think it's really sort of revitalizing that inner core of the city. So I've kind of tried to make peace with the traffic, but he does not. He says that's where I get all my rage out. I'm like, I'm not sure we want all of your rage to get out. He's English. Like, aren't you supposed to keep that in and just stuff it down and, you know, stiff up a lip, all of that? So we kind of, you know, threw up our hands and said, if we're not going to win this game, then we don't want to play. So we moved across Atlanta to the unfashionable, which is also the affordable side of town. We got rid of the SUV. We got rid of the truck. He's still kind of upset about the truck, if I'm being honest.
Yeah, the steering wheel had air conditioning.
Exactly. It also had a name. Its name was Lord Truckington.
Well, he's English.
Exactly. Yes. So it was a very fancy truck. When it's got a title, you know, a truck name with the title of Lord is a fancy, fancy truck. But yeah, so we just kind of downsized everything, went back to really living really simply. We still have a nice place, right? Like, we're in a 3-bedroom, 2-bath, 2,000 square foot home. There's nothing wrong with it, but it was so much cheaper. It was about half the price of the house we were living in on the other side of town. And, you know, if you cut your house in half, all of a sudden, that's actually why the truck had to go, because our truck payment after we moved was more than the cost of the mortgage. And, wow. You know, yeah. So we just kind of Marie Kondo'd the truck. I would go to him, you know, I'd go in every couple of months and say, is the truck still sparking joy? Is it sparking $650 a month worth of joy? And eventually he was like, well, I guess it is kind of unnecessary. People would ask us why we needed the truck. We're like, we don't need the truck. We just, you know, he wanted the truck. He works hard. He should be able to spend his money on fancy things if, you know, that's the whole point of working.
So Lisa, I have to jump in here because this is amazing. So you're talking about this hedonic treadmill when you're on the fashionable side of Atlanta and you're buying all these fancy things. And then just in your story, it's almost like blasé. Oh yeah, we just decided one day to pick up and move. People don't just decide. There usually has to be some awakening. And since we're talking about mindset, bring us back to that moment, because that's not an easy thing, right? Like, you're living this upper middle class or upper class lifestyle with all these fancy toys, and then you decide to change just on a dime. Like, how does that happen?
Yeah, it's probably a question a therapist should ask me. I'm not sure that I really have a good answer for it. And then I really, really processed it. It was definitely on my side. I was sort of the one driving the consumption. And so I was then the one that changed and started driving the downsizing. My poor husband's kind of just along for the ride.
Like, okay, imagine that.
Yeah. What crazy thing is she going to do next? Who knows? I think it had a lot to do with sort of getting back to my roots. My parents made good money, but they were never flashy with it. I grew up in a really small town. There was one Mercedes in town, and we all knew who drove it. There was just nothing fancy. Well, there was a doctor in town who built a fancy house, and then the other doctor had to build a fancy house. But other than that, everybody lived really modestly, and it wasn't about being flashy with money. And I can remember coming to Atlanta just after college, and I had traveled abroad too. So, you know, sort of my standard, mental standard of what was required and what was normal was set at a pretty low point. And then you come to Atlanta and you see all of the flashy things and all the giant McMansions, and you think, wow, these people really know how to live. And, you know, and I think I just chased that for long enough, especially with the recession. I think if the recession had not come along, I might have quite happily stayed on the hamster wheel. But when you get to this point where, you know, I'm working my tail off, I'm, you know, doing supposedly everything right, and it's just not happening, you know, I'm going to go back to my true values, back to what's really important to me. I want to have a nice life. You know, we're not living in a van down by the river by any stretch of the imagination, but just really getting back to what matters and also wanting to have something to show for it. Because we'd gone through this whole roller coaster of the economy going up and making lots of money and the economy coming down. And, you know, we were still paying our bills, but there was nothing extra. And it was just sort of like, we didn't have a lot to show for it other than what we do have a financial planner that we work with and sort of what he pushed us into setting aside strictly just to reduce our tax bill was really all we had to show for it. If we hadn't worked with him, we'd probably have nothing. And so it was just kind of this point of like, I don't see the point of this. This is silly. Like, it looked like a fun game to play, but if I'm not going to win, then what's the point? Like, let me just go back to what really matters to me. What's really important, having a nice, quiet life, not trying to chase being flashy, not trying to chase having all the things, and just go back to what I know works. And I will say our life is so much simpler now. The more you own, they say the things that you own you. And the less you have, the less you have to pay for, the less you have to maintain. It just is really was a process of simplification for us.
Yeah, I think one of the things that really stood out to me was just before the recession, so 2006, 2007, you're kind of chasing this life, this aspirational life that everybody around you looks like they have, looks like they're pulling off, right? It just works. This is what you do. And it wasn't until the recession hit that you realize that it's kind of an illusion, right? This doesn't exist for most people. Most people look like they're winning, but in fact, they're barely sustaining, and it only works if everything goes perfect. That's a pretty big wake-up call, I would imagine.
Yeah, it really was. And if you really look back to the values I was raised with, money was pretty taboo in our household, so we didn't get a lot of financial education, but we did catch some things just from the values that our parents had that we kind of picked up on. And it was very much that millionaire next door lifestyle mentality of you don't need to be flashy. You don't need to try to impress other people. In fact, you know, that was a little frowned upon in my household growing up, but just living a simple life, living a nice life and building for the future, but doing it quietly, right? It's not about what everybody else thinks. It's not about having the biggest house. The bigger house you have, the more furniture you need, the bigger closet you have, the more clothes you're going to buy. It just one decision, you know, it's sort of a spiral. One decision drives another decision, drives another decision. And before you know it, you're just in this sort of mindless consumption habit and you have to keep working to maintain it. And I find it's not ultimately fulfilling at all.
Yeah, I completely hear you, Lisa. And I'm curious more about this transition that you've undertaken. Obviously, you downsize the house, the fancy car with the air-conditioned steering wheel is gone. Like, that's a big deal, obviously. But it sounds like, especially you're talking about Marie Kondo and downsizing, right? Like, what else have you done other than those two major items? Like, what does your life look like on that micro level?
Well, we also have a second home, which we were at a conference and a colleague of my husband's, was saying, I'm in a little bit of a slump. You know, my energy is not where it used to be. And so this colleague of my husband had said, oh, well, we bought a mountain house and I go there on the weekend and I really get away from it all. And that just, you know, completely fixed me. My husband came back and he said, well, I don't think I need a mountain house, but a lake house would be nice. And so, you know, I'm action oriented. I'm get it done right now. And so we went on Google and the closest lakes around Atlanta are Allatoona and Lanier, but they are super expensive. And so I sort of started zooming out on the map and we found Weiss Lake, which is just across the border in Alabama. And so we ended up buying the vacation house there and it does work. We don't have a TV, which I think is part of the magic. We joke that my husband says it may not really be that time slows down. It might just be that you're so bored. It feels like the weekend lasts way too long. But it really does. It gives us an opportunity to get away from it all. There's something about the human psyche that really likes looking at water. And so it's just very soothing, very relaxing. And the obvious thing to do as part of this whole downsizing is like, well, we don't need two houses. We only get over there every couple of weekends. We should sell it. But I didn't really want to sell it, right? It's a lake house. It's awesome. And so the compromise was we started doing short-term vacation rentals through HomeAway, which on the back end is the same company now as VRBO. So you can find it on either site. You know, I thought it was going to be a lot of work in terms of getting it marketed. I had made flyers and was taking them to the local coffee shop and, you know, expecting to put a lot of effort into it. But since that marketplace is already there, I also didn't think anybody knew where Weiss Lake was, but it turns out there's enough people coming through that either want to go fishing for a weekend, they do some fishing tournaments. Also people that are going maybe to a wedding in the area. We're pretty close to Berry College in Rome, Georgia, and I don't think they have enough housing there when people come in for graduation. So we've had people rent at our place, and it's kind of their little vacation lake house getaway while they're close enough to go to things at Berry. And so it's really taken off. I do get it professionally deep cleaned once a month, but a lot of times I'll just go over for the day and kind of turn it on my own, or we'll go for the weekend. And then when we're done, we'll, you know, take everything out of the refrigerator, strip the beds and get it ready for guests coming in the future. So it's really not been too much of an additional workload once we kind of got in the habit of it. And so it was a way to take something we already had and turn it really from a liability into an asset. So I'm all about that. You know, anytime you have something spare, is there a way to monetize the extras that you have that you do want to hang on to?
So Lisa, talk me through that initial moment when you actually try to turn this into a short-term rental. So, okay, you've got this house that you guys use as your second home, right? Your vacation home. So presumably it's furnished, it has all your things in it. And now you're deciding, hey, I want to put this on VRBO. What does the stepwise process look like for that? Because I think Jonathan and I are always trying to get across like actionable content. There are undoubtedly are people listening to this in your exact same situation, and they don't know the first three steps to take to get from here to there. So can you just talk us through the listing, what you actually did to the home, if you had to like take a lot of your stuff out, just like anything like that would be really helpful just on a granular level.
I would say the first thing is you can just do this while you're over there enjoying the property one weekend. Take a look around and see, is there anything that is super valuable, super sentimental that, you know, if someone breaks it or absconds with it, you're going to be brokenhearted, and just go ahead and take that and take it home with you. We don't have anything that's super valuable. And I will say so far, nobody has taken off with any of the furnishings. But if you have, you know, your great grandmother's quilt or anything like that, that's super sentimental, go ahead, take anything out that you'd be heartbroken if it gets damaged or destroyed. We did purchase extra linens, so extra towels, extra sheets, so that we have enough to rotate out. And, you know, if something happens while people are there, they have spares. We made sure that we had a good set of extra supplies. So we always keep napkins, toilet paper, any sort of disposable items like that on hand. Make sure when you're leaving, you take anything out of the refrigerator that, you know, would creep people out, like half-eaten hot dogs or, you know, anything like that that's too personal. And then I leave the things that I'm happy to share, like, you know, ketchup and sugar and things like that, so that people have some of those immediate things. So really just taking anything that would either creep out a guest or you would be heartbroken if you lost it, and then take really good pictures. We have a friend who has a drone, and they actually came to the lake house for the weekend one time just really for fun. And they brought the drone. He and my husband kind of went and played with that. But while they were doing that, they took some aerial pictures of the house so that potential guests can see how close the neighbors are, what the surrounding area looks like. And we also got sort of upstream and downstream pictures of the water, so you can sort of see what that part of the lake looks like, what the neighborhood is like. And then really good pictures of the interior. You need pictures of the bedrooms, the bathrooms, the kitchen, any features that are going to really bring in guests, anything that makes your house really unique. And I'll also say we have not gone through this process yet, but one of the things we want to do, the house needs some exterior renovations. And so we will do that with sort of an eye for cuteness in mind. I personally don't care how it looks from the street, but it's not got a lot of curb appeal. It's really all about the water and just having a place to stay. But when we do renovate it, we're going to try to add some onto the exterior, add some shutters and expand the porch and just do some things that'll make it look cute for resale value and then also for the listing itself. So that's in terms of getting the house itself ready. That's where I would start.
Awesome. I have a couple follow-up questions just kind of about like the numbers. When I think of a lake house, you know, or maybe here, you know, on the East Coast, you know, a beach house, I think of the properties on the very, very low end starting around 300,000, and you could spend several million if you really wanted to. And, you know, while in your case, you were basically, you said, and you made an awesome point, we took a liability and we turned it into an asset. Many people mm-hmm. may be looking to see whether or not, you know, this is a viable model for them. And I'm curious, while in my mind, those numbers are accurate, I know Georgia, there is massive variability in property prices. And what were you finding in terms of lake house properties in Alabama? I mean, what does it cost to get a lake house?
And it definitely depends how close you are to a big city and how fancy the property itself is. So we paid, I believe it was $125, and it's 2-bedroom, 2-bath. We have invested additional money into it. We rebuilt the dock primarily for safety reasons. We came back one day and the neighbor had told their guests that they could tie up to the dock. And we're like, no, that thing's dangerous. So we thought, well, from a liability perspective, we probably need to get that redone. So we did do that before we started renting it out. And we replaced and expanded the deck on the back. But, you know, $125, 2-bedroom, 2-bath in Alabama. Now, again, this was a couple of years ago. So we've had the economy going up, up, up ever since. So probably be a little bit more expensive now. One thing I recommend, and obviously personal finance is personal, so it's whatever you're comfortable with. There is no guarantee just because you buy a property that people will show up. So we bought this house with the ability, if nobody shows up, we can cover the bills. So I would definitely suggest if people are buying it as an investment, make sure that if no one shows up, you can cover the bills either out of cash flow or at least for a couple of months out of an emergency fund. The first thing that goes in a recession is anything discretionary, and vacation travel is definitely discretionary. Now, I think we would do okay even in a future recession because it's a fairly affordable getaway. It's, you know, cheaper than Disney. But, you know, please don't anybody listen to this and get yourself in a financial bind. For us, this has not been a moneymaker in terms of cash flow, right? So it's not like I can take, you know, $10,000 a year out, and if I get four of these, I can live on it. I've never been able to write myself a check out of the business. So it's possible if you had a different property, if it were more optimized, if you turned it faster between guests, you might be able to squeeze some cash out of it. But for us, it was really just being able to, like we said, kind of turn it from a liability into an asset. So the rental income now pays the mortgage and all of the bills, all of the utility bills, which will go up a little bit. When people are not paying the electricity bill, they go crazy with the air conditioning and leave all the doors open. But we were able to, from the rental income, we can cover the mortgage, all of the utilities, the cost of having somebody come in and deep clean once a month, and some of the repairs. If we're doing a major repair, like when we redid the deck, we took some personal cash and invested that into the property. But that was sort of an optional thing and something that we would have done even if we weren't renting the property out. And we feel like that will help with resale value too. So it's basically a way to get a vacation house for free. But I would say people need to have the cash on hand, either cash flow or savings, to be prepared in case it doesn't run out, in case there's a downturn in the economy, or in case it needs major repairs. Just like, honestly, just like you do with your regular house, you need to be prepared to pay for things around the house, regardless of what else is going on in life.
I think you make a great point in terms of having some margin to be able to do this. And also the why of doing this, it sounds like for you. And again, I want to point to the fact that you were able to take something that was just a straight liability, something that was on your budget month after month that was costing you, and figured out a way to make it net neutral at, you know, kind of the worst side. If I were to go a little farther with that, I am curious, you know, just because with these short-term rentals, you have to have turnover. By definition, these are not people that are staying for months at a time. So in a 30-day period, how many, and I guess I would imagine it would be dependent on season, but just on average, how many days a month does it stay booked? And what is the average listing price for that location?
In terms of average listing price, I've actually just bumped it up. So we'll see whether or not the market will allow that. We usually rent it out for $125 a night during the spring and the fall. when there is less demand. And then, yeah, because kids are in school, so people are not taking vacations, but there are people fishing or maybe retirees that want to get away. So $125 a night during the spring and the fall. We've just bumped it up to $150 a night during the summer and $175 a night for holiday weekends. So we will see if it rents out at that price. I believe last year over the summer, I did $135 during the summer and $150 for holidays, and we didn't have any problem renting it out. Typically, people stay, you know, this is America. We work all the time. We don't get a lot of vacation. So typically, people are taking a three-day weekend. So they might come in Friday morning, lunchtime, stay Friday afternoon and Friday night, all day Saturday, and then they're out, you know, Sunday, midday, in order to give themselves time to come home. So it still does sit empty a good bit of time during the week, especially this time of year when people are still in school. But as we start getting into summer, we do see more people that will take it for a whole week. And one of the things you can do with the pricing on HomeAway and most of these other sites is you can give a discount per night if somebody books for an entire week. So I actually do discount down off the daily rate if you stay for an entire week. Because for me, it's about the same amount of work to turn it if somebody has been there for two nights as it is to turn it if somebody's been there for a whole week. But obviously, it's a lot more profitable for me if they stay for the week. So it's worth it to me to give a discount to try to incent some of those week-long renters. You also have the option to discount if somebody stays more than 30 days. And I actually don't do that because I don't want people to stay for a month. I want them to come, have their vacation, and then go away so that I can use it myself some over the summer. So I'd say during the summer, it stays probably, oh, maybe 60, 70% rented. It'll be rented pretty much every weekend that we don't reserve it for our own personal use between Memorial Day and Labor Day. And it's just kind of up in the air whether those people, most of them will stay for a three-day weekend, but sometimes they'll stay for a week.
And final question, I think this is burning a hole into the minds of our audience. So not having a TV, is that a feature or a bug?
It depends upon who you ask. And I do have it, like, it's the number one top thing in the description, no TV. And then later on down at the bottom where I'm describing the living room, I'm like, no TV. And I still had somebody show up. First off, they showed up a day early. I had gone ahead and sent them the access code and set it up so that they could get in. So that was my mistake. I should have not, you know, given them the access code, or at least not made the access code work until day of. But they showed up a day early. They let themselves in and they said, there's no TV. We're leaving. I was kind of like, okay. You know, if you're that dependent upon the TV, unless there's some sort of sporting event, you know, football season, I get it. That's a deal breaker for some of our potential renters. But I really feel like we spend too much time interacting with each other virtually and not enough time interacting with each other in real life. So there's a couple of reasons for it. One is if we buy the TV, there's no cable. So we're going to look at, we'd have to put in a satellite dish. We have to hang it somewhere. It's another bill that you're creating. And then just the way the house is configured, there's not a really good place physically to put it where people could sit and look at it. And then on top of that, it really does, it sucks up all of your time. And when you don't have the TV, now we do have pretty good high-speed internet, especially given where we are. And so if you want to stare at your screen and not interact with the people that you paid to hang out with, you can still do that. There's ways to get around it. My husband's been over there and watched, again, he's English, so he's watched his Premier League football, watched soccer on his iPad, and, you know, watched, I always call it the car driving, the Formula One. So he's watched Formula One there. So it's fast enough that you can stream content if you want. But not having the TV, I think people tend to spend more time. The best feature of the house is the screened-in back porch. And just to sit out there, maybe have a iced tea or some other kind of beverage and just look at the water and visit with your friends. We have a good stash of board games. You'll be excited to know, Jonathan.
I do approve.
Yeah, yeah. And people, you know, when there's no TV, as it starts to get dark, people get a little restless. They're like, well, we've eaten dinner. What do we do now without a television? people will pull out the board games and, you know, you get some adults around playing Clue. It starts to get pretty heated. So
have you gotten any reviews on your VRBOs saying anything like, I am so glad they don't have TV at this location? Anything like that?
Yeah. 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 We have one that says no TV, no problem. And they said, wow, I didn't realize how much time we must spend watching TV because we had so much more downtime this weekend. It was so relaxing. And not having the noise, you know, a lot of people, you walk into the house and the TV is always on. It's just that constant, I don't know. And I have mixed feelings about TV. You know, obviously there's certain shows that we love and we enjoy, but we have a total HGTV ban in our household. Like, turn off HGTV.
How much money has that saved you?
Oh, a fortune, a fortune. Yeah, you notice it's sponsored by Lowe's and by Home Depot because all the TV show does is make you feel dissatisfied with your house. You're like, my kitchen is terrible. Now, you know, keep in mind, we never cook. So as long as the kitchen, as long as the dishwasher works and the microwave, right? Like we're not cooking like we should be to be five people. But, you know, your kitchen is fine. Your bathrooms are fine. Turn off the TV. It's creating a desire that Lowe's and Home Depot show up to fill. And it's just keeping you in this cycle of consumerism. I can remember being a kid and we didn't know, like, you might know that grandma's house was kind of weird looking, but but you didn't have this sense of like, oh, this whole thing needs to be gutted, right?
They need granite, right, Lisa?
Yes, we need granite countertops. We can't live without granite countertops. Like, you'll be fine. You'll suffer through somehow. You know, think of the pilgrims who came to this country on the Mayflower without granite countertops and somehow were able to survive. Like, you'll be fine. So yeah, stop watching HGTV. It's just there to sell you stuff.
Yeah. And I love the TV ban as like a feature of this. It reminds me, there's this company, it's called Getaway. I think it's getaway.house is their website. And they basically have tiny houses in the woods outside of like major metro areas like Atlanta and DC and New York. You just rent a tiny house. And one of the features they have is they have a lockbox for your cell phone. How cool is that? Lisa, you should put that in your vacation rental, right? Like, how amazing would that be?
My wife would book that residence just for that alone. Like, she would sort through it. If that were like a something you could tick, she would only look at vacation properties that had a cell phone lockbox. I guarantee it. Well, it's here. We have to use it.
You have a problem. Yeah.
Biting it.
So Lisa, I know one of the current aspects of what you're doing in your life is financial coaching. And this has become a really essential part of what your life looks like now. And I'd love to hear about the transition and how you decided to get into this.
Well, we still have the business as our side hustle. So my husband has a full-time job with really great insurance, which is awesome. That was our biggest client. Now they went through a whole thing trying to interview people and went through several rounds. And finally he went in and he said, do you want me to continue to help you and just to pay me differently? And they said, yeah. So we have that business coming in that's just paid differently. We still have the IT consulting business. But part of what came out of all of that downsizing was obviously I had some free time. The IT consulting business, as it transitions from full-time to part-time, that left me with some time on my own. And I really was trying to figure out, what do I want to do with that time? We don't have kids, and stay-at-home dog mom, it turns out, is not a thing. So I wanted to do something where I could give back and where I could pass on what we had learned. And so that's really when I started looking at opportunities in the financial world to help people. But I wasn't as interested in the investing part. I feel like once you have money, people sort of come out of the woodwork for, you know, some with good intentions, some maybe not so much, but people kind of come out of the woodwork and they want to help you do things with that money. The real challenge most people face is, how do I get to the point where I have money? And that's the part that really fascinates me.
So Lisa, I actually want to explore that a little bit further. A lot of people in our community are hardcore DIYers, and I certainly identify with that to some varying degree, as does Brad, but there are things that we rely on other people for help with. You know, it's not that you never get help with anything. And in fact, there are people in our community that are trying to figure out how to bridge that. You know, where do I go to find a trusted resource for help with something that I'm just not comfortable doing? And I'm curious, with all the different types of advice and coaching and planners that are out there, how would you recommend that someone sift through that to find the right person if they themselves feel like they need help?
Gotcha. Okay. Well, I think the first place to look is sort of what time period are you looking for help with? And I'm completely stealing this idea from Kelsa Dickey at Financial Fitness Phoenix. She always explains the difference between a CPA, a coach, and a planner or advisor in terms of the time scale. So a CPA is very helpful in terms of looking back historically. What did you do over the last year? How did it go? How do we report that to the IRS? Some CPAs will do more than that. They do help you with future planning, business planning strategy, but their primary function is that accounting, looking in the rearview mirror to make sure that you have a good understanding of where you were. A planner or advisor is primarily focused on long-term planning. How do we get set for retirement? How do we invest for children's college? And some of them will do help with saving and budgeting and investing, but really they don't get paid if they are an advisor unless you invest with them. If they're a fee-only planner, they can more go in the direction you want to go because they're paying for your time. But their primary focus is always going to be on the future with more of an eye towards investing. A coach is different because a coach tends to be more focused on the here and now. So what behavior are you engaging in, often unconsciously, that might be sabotaging your efforts? So some coaches are very sort of grounded and tactical. Let's work on your budget. Let's look at your spending. And some are a little bit more on the woo-woo mindset side, where it's, you know, more about sort of discovering your values and discovering your mindsets. I like to be kind of in the middle, but more on the mindset side, because I feel like that's what messes people up. So in terms of DIY versus getting help, if you've decided that you do need assistance, figure out which piece you need assistance with. Is it with the past and getting your tax returns done? Is it with the future, long-term investing, figuring out how your money maps to your goals? Or is it with the here and now of trying to figure out, how do I manage my day-to-day cash flow so that there is money to invest? And how do I see if there's anything in my own mind that might be holding me back on the earning side or might be causing me to sabotage my own efforts?
You know, one of the common threads or themes that we see when someone is getting started on their journey to financial independence, or frankly, just getting to debt free, starting to pay off their debt, it always starts with tracking their finances. And I think it's easy for, you know, potentially even me and Brad to take it for granted that, well, you just need to track how much you make and how much you spend, right? So easy, just do it. But people struggle with that.
Yes. And I think it's different for different people, depending upon how sort of pro spreadsheet you are. I do feel like most people are able to look back at their historical spending, especially now all your data is available. Most people know their day-to-day expenses. They know how much my rent or my mortgage is, roughly how much my utilities are. They have a pretty good understanding about what I'm spending on a day-to-day basis in terms of shopping and things like that. Maybe not in individual categories, but at least on the whole, right? Because it's everything left after I pay the have-tos, everything left is in that other category. What tends to mess people up are the big annual expenses. I personally use You Need a Budget. And what I did when I was getting started with that is I looked at my past spending and figured out what I had been spending, used that as a basis for the budget. I plugged that into You Need a Budget, which has a website, and then there's also a mobile app. And You Need a Budget is, I had used Quicken in the past, but for whatever reason, I don't know, Quicken just felt really stale and I wanted a fresh approach. YNAB, You Need a Budget, is really good about helping you with those sinking funds. So I have at the top all of my regular bills, all of my spending. And then there's a section at the bottom where I put things like a big insurance bill that comes up once a year, vacation, any of those big expenses that you need to divide by 12 and start building towards. And for whatever reason, for me, it works so much better than the saving goals in Quicken used to work. They, for whatever reason, they had no power over me, but something about the way YNAB is laid out, you know, I see those categories and I see like, you know, possible tax bill in March and now it's September and it says zero. And I'm like, oh God, I really have to focus on that. So using that tool has helped us. We have had more cash in our checking account from using that than we've ever had before. And just that right there helps cushion you from a lot of the ups and downs. So if I'm saving towards a big insurance bill in September, but you know, I need new tires, I can kind of dip into that and pay myself back. So it's a good starting place for somebody that's never gotten control over their spending and never been able to build up an emergency fund to start working towards some of that and get a handle on their day-to-day spending.
Hey, Lisa, so I want to dive into this a little bit. You talked about mindset and you've talked about that throughout the episode, how important it is. And I mean, you've undergone a significant mindset change in your own life, both personally, but in your profession as well. And you've gone from an employee to an entrepreneur. And I'd love to hear about your journey and how it's informed you, maybe to help your own clients.
Absolutely. And I actually do a lot of startup coaching. I think everybody should have a side hustle, even if you don't make any money at it. I feel like the mindset benefits are huge because when you own your own business, you start to think about where does the money come from and where does the money go? And then if you take that back into your day job and you think, how does my company make money and what does it spend money on? If there's a way, even if it's a little outside of your role, to impact either of those numbers for a business, you will be very, very popular as an employee. If you can, I don't know, come from IT and say, hey, I noticed we're not doing anything to gather leads off the website. I know, Mr. IT Director, this is a little outside of my normal role, but do you think it would be appropriate for me to talk to marketing or talk to sales and see if that might be helpful to them? If you can do something that helps bring in more money or helps cut expenses, you're going to be way more popular at work. You're going to be the last one to get laid off in a recession because they see that you're not just there for a paycheck. You're really helping drive the business. So I feel like that entrepreneurial mindset, first off, the best way to develop it is by doing. A lot of reading, a lot of hanging out with people that have done what you want to do, whether it's in reality or virtually, podcasts and blogs, but really soaking in that mindset and then applying it into the rest of your life is so valuable.
That's amazing. There's so much there that I hope our audience grasps just in that soundbite. When you can apply an entrepreneurial mindset to your position as an employee, you become irreplaceable. And when that happens, you get to set the parameters of your job, of your work. You get to command you basically get to focus on the parts of your job that light you up and get rid of the aspects that burn you out, essentially making you enjoy your job more. I mean, that's ultimately what this comes down to. And so many people just look at their current roles and responsibility list and kind of limit themselves to how can I do the bare minimum here and never even think about what you just expressed. There's so much power in grasping onto that idea. I think when you try to bring those two together, I think what it comes down to is value. What is it that you actually value? And if you're just buying everything, you're never forced to really think about that, which kind of puts you on that hedonic treadmill that you reference. How do you bridge the gap between mindset and, you know, the actionable step of making a budget?
Well, I really suggest people do start with their values. If you ask most people, what's the most important thing in your life? If they have kids, they'll say kids. You say, okay, great. So your kids are 10 and 12. How much do you have saved for college? And they're like, whoa, I don't value them that much. And not that you, no, I don't value them more than a trip to Target. What are we talking about here? Not that you have to pay for your kids' college, but if that's important to you and that is a value for you, you need to put money towards the things that matter to you most first, and then adapt your spending to that. So instead of saying, I will save for retirement when I have extra money, I will save for the kids' college when I have extra money, I'll just tell you, if you're a natural spender like my husband and I are, there is no such thing as extra money. It doesn't matter how much you have coming in. You can always outspend your ability to earn. You know, you even see celebrities that do this. They have these crazy lavish lifestyles. They're making tons of money, but it doesn't matter how much you make. It's really how much you spend. So put your values first. If kids' college is important to you, if retirement is important to you, if a family vacation once a year is important to you, put that first. And if you get to the point where, I've put money towards all the things that really matter, and now I can't afford my mortgage payment, this is controversial. And again, personal finance is personal, whatever someone wants to do, but maybe you need to look at how much you're spending on the house. We tend to think that the house and the cars, look at how we write down our list of expenses. Number one, mortgage. Number two, car payment. What if you flip that on its head and you say, I'm going to set aside the amount of money that I think is appropriate for the things that are most important to me, and then I'm going to live on what's left, instead of living as lavishly as you can, or at least at a level that quote unquote seems normal, and then trying to fund your goals and your values and the things that matter most to you out of the leftovers. You really need to align your values with your spending, and then everything, I think, should be on the table.
Lisa, I don't think I've ever heard someone, and we've used a lot of words on this show, but I don't think we have ever put aligning your spending with your values as articulate as you did on this particular episode. So thank you for sharing with us and with our audience. For people that are listening to this episode and want to connect with you, want to connect with your content and find out more about your coaching, what is the best way for someone to connect with you?
Well, I do have a website with a blog associated with that. So if you want to check that out, it's just at lisaduke.net. If you want to go straight to the blog and avoid all of the commercial for my coaching, it's lisaduke.net/blog. The initial posts are really kind of around my backstory, how we got to where we are. And then the ones from this spring are more sort of stream of consciousness, what's going on with money, recommendations I make to folks. I have some client case studies on there. So that's a great way to connect with me. My contact information is on the website, my cell phone number and my email. And I will say, I've got a special offer. If anyone is listening to this and wants a little bit more one-on-one help, my goal is to have 100 one-on-one money conversations between now and FinCon. And so if you're thinking, gosh, I'd just like to pick the brain of an entrepreneur, I'd like to pick the brain of a financial coach, then send me an email. It's lisa@lisaduke.net. And if you'll put choose FI in the subject line and say, hey, I'd like to get on your calendar and spend an hour picking your brain, I would love to do that. And everything you give me will be confidential.
Awesome. Well, in most shows, that would be the end of the episode. But on this show, Lisa, we would love to give you the chance to tackle the hot seat. Are you ready for this?
I was born ready.
In a world drowning in debt and rampant consumption, trapped by the chains of lifestyle inflation, these questions highlight the secrets of those who have broken free. Welcome to the Choose FI Hot Seat.
All right, Lisa, question number one, your favorite blog that's not your own.
Bitches Get Riches. I don't know if we can say that. This is a family show, but they're just, it's two ladies. They go by the pen names of Piggy and Kitty. They're so funny and they're such like just tough chicks and they give such great advice. There's a lot around finances, but it tends to go into other things as well, career advice for folks that are in the working world. And they just crack me up. So I think that's a great place to check out if you like funny money conversations.
Yeah, that's funny. We actually met them this year at FinCon and yeah, hung out with them a good bit. And really, like you said, just super cool, really smart, funny. Like that is a great, great website. So yeah, good recommendation for sure.
All right. Question number two, your favorite article of all time.
I want to give a shout out to Josh Overmeyer. I met him at Camp Fi down in Florida and he's got one. This is going to be a little controversial because I know we have a lot of craft beer fans in the listening audience, but he has a post called Drank the Emergency Fund. And I just think about how much money we spent in our 20s on going out and bar hopping, on bottles of liquor. And, you know, again, everything is choices. So if you're making a conscious choice to get a six pack of craft beer to share with your friends, I have no problem with that. But as with everything, it's about being intentional and making some deliberate choices. And I haven't seen anybody else in the financial independence community poke that hornet's nest of like, think about how much money goes into alcohol. So I just think it's a neat take on money that I haven't seen anywhere else.
Yeah, I hear you, Lisa. And it's what's actually really funny is I had a meetup in Naples, Florida, just a couple of weeks ago with Josh and a couple other members of the local.
Did you enjoy some
community
craft beer?
We actually did, which is so ironic. No, Josh is fantastic. I've hung out with him in the state of Florida 3 times in the last 6 months, which is just absolutely hilarious. And I didn't realize it until he mentioned it. But yeah, super great guy. And yeah, he blogs at joshovermeyer.com, right?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. All right. Question number 3, your favorite life hack.
Oh, downsizing. And I know I've talked about that a lot.
Yeah, but you Marie Kondo'd your truck.
Yes, we recondoed the truck that had the air conditioned steering wheel.
Lord Truckles?
But
no, that wasn't
yeah,
it.
Lord Truckington. Lord Truckington. Lord Truckington the first. like Game of Thrones, right? Lord Truckington first of his name. But downsizing, when we downsized the house and the mortgage payment got smaller, that's what made the truck payment look funny in comparison. The truck payment seemed totally appropriate when we were in the more expensive house. So downsize the house. It saves you money on not just the mortgage, but your insurance, your utilities, the amount of money you put into furniture, the amount of money you put into everything. And then it also makes everything else look a little more lavish in comparison once you've downsized your house.
All right, Lisa, question number 4, your biggest financial mistake.
Ooh, financial mistake, just from a purely financial perspective, it would be joining a network marketing company, which I do not recommend. Of course, everybody's opinion is different, especially when they're in the midst of trying to work within a network marketing company. They tend to be real in favor of it for that time period. But I had a really good corporate job and I was not happy and I wanted to do something more entrepreneurial. And in theory, going from corporate to network marketing to your own business is a good transition, but it tends to be very expensive. I was in the top 2% of the company. I earned the use of 2 company cars. You know, I was at a very high level and I still was making peanuts, and everything I made went back either into product, into conferences, into training. So it was great from a mindset perspective, but I think if I had stayed in my corporate job and maybe gone to like a Tony Robbins conference and, you know, hired an entrepreneur to coach me, I probably would have come out ahead financially.
No controversial statements in here at all.
I know you're going to get hate mail from people that are like, I used to be so great in my network marketing company. It's like, can I see your tax return?
Stunned silence from Brad and Jonathan. No, that's awesome. All right, Lisa, question number 5, the advice you would give your younger self.
Ooh, start meditating. And I'm not even like level 1 meditator. I have yet to establish a super consistent practice and really, you know, get all of the benefits. But just from tinkering with it, I find that it really helps me be more calm, less emotionally reactive, less scattered. So I'm still very much in the beginning phase, but I think meditation is huge. And you've been meditating as well, Brad, haven't you? I think I've heard you talk about it.
Yeah, definitely. I have been meditating similar to you. I get into a practice and then I kind of don't do it every day, but I find just so much more relaxed and calm and just have that little perspective on days that I do it, which begs the question, hey, Bozo, why don't you do it every single day, right? But it's just getting into the habit of doing it every morning. So I use the Headspace app. I've used the app Calm as well. I generally prefer Headspace slightly more. But yeah, they're both wonderful. And I'm not even at level 1. Like, I don't know that's necessarily how I look at it. It's almost like being a little too hard on yourself. It's just about creating that space, taking deep breaths, and just relaxing and getting away from the constant notifications on your phone and your computer.
And your TV. Really I know a property in Georgia that you could go for like 3 days, no TV allowed, and a new cell phone box is being added.
Love the features. Love the features.
Hey, Lisa, we have a bonus question for you. What purchase have you made over the past 12 months that has brought the most value to your life?
I'm a big fan of the Ring doorbell and the various Ring camera products. We have a Ring doorbell on the front door here. And so I work from home. A lot of times I'm here by myself. I am on the affordable side of town. So there was a little bit of a unfounded security concern when we first moved in. But the Ring doorbell is great because if anybody rings the doorbell or if they're in front of the front door and the motion sets it off, I can see them. I can talk back and forth with them. And I don't have to open the front door. So it's great if I'm here and working from home and there's somebody at the door that I don't want to open the door to when I'm here by myself. It's also great when we travel. If we go to the lake for the weekend and it looks like nobody's here and somebody's ringing the door to, I don't know, case the place, then we can answer the door and say, oh, hello. Yes, just leave the package right there. So it gives us a great way to monitor what's going on and to interact with people, even when we're not physically in the property.
Fantastic. Lisa, thank you so much for joining us on the show today. You are a rock star.
Yay. Thank you, Brad and Jonathan. I really appreciate the opportunity and I look forward to hearing from folks in the audience.
To our audience, Lisa is just as awesome in person as she was on this podcast, I can assure you, and she would love to connect with you. So definitely shoot her an email if you are interested in her offer. If you got value from today's episode, if you've been getting value from the episodes up to this point, just take 1 second and press the subscribe button on the platform you're listening to this on. Just lets the providers know you're getting value from the show and you want to be here when we produce additional content. If you want to support us and what we're doing here at Choose FI, here are 4 easy ways. 1, leave us an iTunes review. To do that, just go to choosefi.com/iTunes. 2, use our page to sign up for travel credit cards. If you want to travel the world with miles and points instead of your hard-earned dollars, then just go to choosefi.com/cards and get started today. 3, if you're working on the milestones of FI, set up a personal capital account to track your progress and use our affiliate link. It's completely free and just go to choosefi.com/PC. P as in Paul, C as in Cat. And 4, and most importantly, find your friends, coworkers, and family members who might be open to this message and tell them about the podcast. Have them start with episode 100. It is a fantastic starting place. All right, my friends, the fire is spreading. We'll see you next time as we continue to go down the road less traveled.
You've been listening to Choose FI Radio Podcast, where we help middle-class America build wealth, one life hack at a time.